closer look at Florida's growing medical cannabis industry. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross and hope you had a great Memorial Day holiday. We are back on the air, always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, it is certainly an emerging industry in this state. A closer look at Florida's growing cannabis industry. What are your thoughts? Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's this month's edition of First Coast Success as we speak with one of the most successful CEOs in town, the founder of Champion Brands, Earl Benton Jr. Plus, it's an option for your child's summer camp this season. We'll spotlight the First Coast Rowing Club and their champion rowers. And our own Electro Lounge host, David Luckham, will stop by with some new music, too. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, medical marijuana in Florida is already the law of the land. And now, pending an appeal, you can also smoke the drug to cure what ails you. Last week, a judge ruled the ban on smoking cannabis for medical use in the state is unconstitutional. The Florida Department of Health is appealing that ruling, but it's seen as the latest victory for proponents of medical marijuana in the state. And on the business side, the cannabis industry is booming with new dispensaries opening in all corners of Florida. But there are still challenges and restrictions around this emerging market. We are beginning the hour with a closer look at the lay of the land when it comes to cannabis in Florida. Here with his thoughts on this space, we welcome Attorney Matthew Ginder. He's senior counsel in the Cannabis Law Practice Group at the South Florida firm Greenspoon Martyr. Matthew, thanks for being with us.
No, thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts on this judge's ruling saying that smokable medical marijuana should be allowed? There has been a ban on that. And what are your thoughts about medical marijuana emerging as a growth industry in this state, cannabis? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we also welcome your thoughts on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. And this certainly is an emerging industry, Matthew Ginder. Marijuana is still a Schedule I illegal drug under federal law. But the momentum is certainly swinging towards legalization, Florida joining 43 other states and the District of Columbia in allowing medical marijuana. And now this judge in Leon County has ruled that the ban on smoking it to treat your symptoms is unconstitutional. Let me begin by asking you, what's your reaction, first off, to the judge's ruling and also the appeal from the State Department of Health?
Yeah, I think the judge's ruling is very positive for patients and advocates. But I will note that it is the first decision at the trial level. As you noted, this case has already been appealed by the state and will likely be ultimately decided by the Florida Supreme Court. It's such an issue of great public importance that I believe that the Florida Supreme Court will ultimately weigh in on determining whether smokable marijuana is legal under the Florida Constitution.
And in the states that allow marijuana to be smoked, how many states that have legalized marijuana for medical use allow it to be taken in that manner?
I don't have the statistics on that, but there are a significant amount of states that do allow smokable marijuana. For example, Arizona allows smoking for their medical program. Most states out west that have legalized recreational use, of course, smoking is permitted. And then when we see the more conservative states on the East Coast or states that are just rolling out their medical marijuana programs, we're seeing a more limited approach. At least on the onset, restricting the use of medical marijuana for smoking.
And as we speak with Attorney Matthew Ginder, who is in the area of cannabis law, what are your thoughts about this emerging industry in Florida, cannabis? Give us a call at 549-2937. And so with the passage of the constitutional amendment, Matthew, that legalized this drug in 2016, we've seen doctors undergoing special training to distribute this drug. There are more than a dozen medical marijuana treatment centers that have been licensed throughout the state. Certainly, investors are eyeing Florida. A New York firm bought a Florida operation called Grow Healthy for $47 million earlier this year. So there's outside money coming into this state. You are involved in the licensing, regulatory and compliance and business issues around cannabis. Can you talk a little bit about how big a business this is now in the state and what you're forecasting, how you think this is going to develop down the road?
Yeah, so Florida is has potential to be one of the largest markets in the country just by the sheer amount of patients or potential patients and the population, and combined with that and the demographics of the state, it's a very appealing market for investors or businesses to operate in. Again, these are all these medical marijuana programs are intrastate, meaning they operate within states. So every state acts almost like its own country. And the laws that were passed in Florida create not many, but large business opportunities for the industry.
We've heard a lot about the firm Trulieve. That's one dispensary that seems to have gained a foothold. What else? Who are some of the other players out there?
Yeah, so right now there are, as you mentioned, there are 13 licenses that have been issued. Now, a licensed entity is called a medical marijuana treatment center here in Florida, and what that license allows you to do is establish up to 25 dispensary stores throughout the state, and Trulieve has certainly been the most aggressive with their retail approach. They may have over a dozen stores already. In addition to Trulieve, there's Surterra, Curaleaf, Knox, and a couple others. Of those 13 that have been issued licenses, I believe about 6 or 7 of them are operational, meaning they're dispensing to patients. The other 6 or 7 are going through the process of becoming operational. They just need certain authorizations from the state to begin dispensing medical marijuana. So we're seeing some competition in the market right now, but it will double within the next year once these second tranche of licenses become operational.
Haven't there been a lot of delays and bureaucratic snafus with the rollout of this industry as well? I mean, you're talking about a state government that was so opposed to this becoming legal. So what are you seeing as these businesses that seek to enter this industry in Florida, some of the problems and challenges they're reporting that they're dealing with?
Yeah, there's challenges on many fronts. For the current operators, there's some challenges at the local level. For companies that want to enter the business, there's been some delays there. Under the state law, the Department of Health was supposed to issue additional licenses pursuant to a competitive application process. That was supposed to occur in the fall of 2017. So we're almost a year in, and we still haven't begun the application. The Department of Health has not began accepting applications for 8 more licenses that were supposed to be issued last year. So I think there's some frustration for companies that want to, or investors that want to enter the market due to those delays. And then there's been some frustration, I'm sure, by the current operators that want to expand, and they're facing some challenges at the local level. Every city and county is determining how they should regulate the zoning of these dispensaries, and a lot of the cities and counties have decided to ban or place a moratorium on on dispensaries. So that's created some hurdles for current operators in finding, you know, attractive or desirable locations to serve patients.
And we're talking about the business of cannabis in Florida. It's seen as a huge emerging market. Lots of hurdles, though, as we're learning from attorney Matthew Ginder. He's in the practice of cannabis law in South Florida. What are your thoughts about medical marijuana in the state? 549-2937. Tim is on the north side right now. Hi, Tim. Good morning. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was saying there's a person that answered my call. There are other ways to consume leaf marijuana. You don't have to smoke it. It can be vaporized. And it's a much healthier way to take it into your system.
Right. And so are you, you're opposed then to the judge's ruling that allows it to be smoked?
Well, not at all. You cannot buy leaf or bud quality marijuana in Florida other than through the monopolies that are set up already, like Trulieve. They have their own marijuana leaf packets that are little cartons loaded with, I think it's 1 gram of leaf marijuana made for their vaporizer. You cannot use that kind of product in any other vaporizer.
Okay.
But if it were loose leaf, you could use it in any vaporizer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for that, Matthew. Go ahead.
Yes, so Tim is correct that currently vaping flower is permissible under state law, so long as that flower is in a tamper-proof receptacle. So what he is referring to is Trulieve offers a vape cartridge with a tamper-proof top that allows you to vape the flower, and that is one of the product offerings that is legal under Florida state law. The only restriction in Florida currently is the ban on smoking. And that was what was, you know, the ruling Friday was about.
What about his comment that Trulieve has a monopoly on this business? How do you see different growers and different businesses competing for what you said looks to be a pretty big market? There's certainly a lot of money to be made with the growth and marketing of this substance. So what about that side of this?
Yeah, that was a big sticking point in the Florida legislature when they were deciding how to structure the licenses and in the state and how many to offer. The competition, in my opinion, is always good, and the more market participants, the better off it is for patients. He's certainly correct in the sense that Florida laws do restrict competition in comparison to the amount of patients that will be, participating in this program. I think the state could have done a better job of offering more licenses. With that said, there will be more competition as the program continues. There will be another 7 licenses that will become operational, which will double the size of the current market participants. And then next year, there will likely be another 8 more companies competing in the marketplace. So we are seeing limited growth in competition. And in my opinion, I agree with Tim that it's not where it should be.
And this is sort of a gray area for you as an attorney, isn't it? You're advocating on behalf of cannabis-related businesses for the distribution of a drug that overwhelmingly the voters say they want. And a majority of states have voted this way, but at the federal level, it's still classified as a Schedule I illegal drug. And you have Attorney General Jeff Sessions saying that he believes that we should go back to the way it was before, that this drug should be recriminalized This is, I would think, a very challenging legal area for you in many respects. What are some of the issues and challenges that are cropping up as you go about representing some of these clients?
Yeah, this dichotomy between it being federal illegal and monitoring very closely the policy at the federal level, and contrast that by the widespread support and public support, not only in Florida, but nationwide. I mean, the support for medical marijuana may hit 90% on recent pollings. So, yeah, it prevents the federal illegality of medical marijuana presents certain obstacles that you just don't see in other industries, whether it's access to banking, whether it's unfair tax treatment, and just the general risk associated, with operating a business that is, in the eyes of the federal government, is illegal. With that said, there are certain protections offered for state medical marijuana businesses that are operating pursuant to state law. There's an appropriations bill that defunds the Department of Justice for using any funds against a business that's operating pursuant to state law and for medical marijuana only. So there are some protections offered to medical marijuana businesses. But on the other hand, the federal legality of the business and the nature of the business has created these unique obstacles and hurdles to operating.
What do you advise people then, individuals or organizations that look at this and say, oh, I can make some money at this. I think I want to invest in cannabis in Florida. What's your advice for that kind of investor?
Well, I'm as a lawyer, I generally focus on the legal aspects of things. Cannabis is, it is an emerging market right now. And we are seeing a lot of investments and money being invested in this industry. But with that comes risk that you ordinarily don't see in other markets. And additionally, there's the profits for these companies are hampered somewhat by the federal tax laws, which taxes cannabis businesses disproportionately higher than any other business. So while it is an emerging market and there's a significant demand, there are certain risks out there that just are unique to this space.
And do you think ultimately market forces will overwhelm that in this state? As you mentioned, there's a lot of conservative opposition at the legislative level, but in the end, it seems money will talk when it comes to this space of cannabis. At least that's the way it's played out in other states.
Yeah, I think the support, I'd find it hard-pressed in this upcoming election to see anybody running or advocating against medical marijuana. It's becoming a bipartisan issue. I think, the public support is overwhelming in favor of it. And just for example, when we voted back in 2016 for the Amendment 2, the Medical Marijuana Ballot Initiative, it passed overwhelmingly by 71%. But if you looked at every single county within the state, every single county voted a majority, at least a majority, in favor of it. So I think it's politically becoming unwise to campaign against medical marijuana. And let me just place the caveat being medical marijuana. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're seeing at the federal level also is gaining more support in Congress at the federal level for medical marijuana. So I think as time goes on, I think we'll see more action and more protections, not only due to lobbying and the industry coalescing and lobbying for more favorable marijuana laws, but I think you'll see will hopefully see the legislature at both the state and federal level mirror its constituents, which is, very supportive of allowing patients to have the right to access medical marijuana for treatment.
Well, we hope you'll drop back in with us later on as we revisit the issue as this sort of rolls out around the state. But thanks so much for being with us this morning. He's Matthew Ginder, senior counsel in the Cannabis Law Practice Group at the South Florida firm of Greenspoon and Martyr. Matthew, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
And much more still ahead later. New music from our own Electro Lounge host, David Luckin. But after the break, Karen Bruni Mathis speaks with the CEO of Champion Brands. That's in our First Coast Success right after this.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Bobby Thomas, beauty and fashion expert and author of The Power of Style, Everything You Need to Know Before You Get Dressed, will be this year's keynote speaker at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel. Bobby, the style editor for The Today Show, will share Bobby's buzz tips on everything from favorite beauty tricks to her favorite lifestyle finds. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, he runs one of the biggest beverage distributors around. In this month's First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record speaks with Earl Benton Jr., founder and CEO of Champion Brands.
Earl Benton bought Duval Beverage Service in 1985, and today his renamed Champion Brands Incorporated distributes products from 62 domestic and foreign breweries and several local craft breweries, and that includes Red Bull and water. He is expanding his South Jacksonville plant to accommodate his 300 employees and growth. Earl Benton, welcome to First Coast Success.
Oh, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Tell us, what does Champion Brands distribute and where, and what are your primary brands?
Well, we are primarily, or we have been primarily, a malt beverage distributor. Primary brands, our largest brands, are those of Miller Coors, followed up by Heineken and Yingling and a host of other brands, too numerous to mention. We also, one of our predominant players is Red Bull. We started with Red Bull in 2001, and with the exciting growth of Red Bull around the world, and especially in the U.S., it looks like we might be a Red Bull distributor one day who also handles malt beverages. They're our second largest supplier. And craft beers also have been very, very important to us. Intuition, Ben Davis, his enterprise. He's now on our top 10 supplier list for competing against people from all over the globe. So craft beers have been very, very important to us.
Talk about your background. Where did you grow up, and what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, I grew up in rural North Carolina. The closest place for my mother to buy groceries was 14 miles away. I grew up on a tobacco farm and spent 22 wonderful summers there. And I knew one thing I did not want to be when I grew up was a tobacco farmer. So I was fortunate enough in high school to be granted an Air Force ROTC scholarship. So I spent 4 years at East Carolina, graduated from there with an accounting degree, and went off to pilot training. Unsuccessfully, I might add, the flight surgeon found some astigmatism in my left eye, and back during this time, you had to be perfect to fly because they were going to invest well over $1 million in a person to teach him how to fly. So they wanted a perfect guy. So I still owed him 4 years. So I went from the excitement of flying a fighter plane, perhaps in Vietnam at the time, which was raging, to being sent to a missile silo in Little Rock, Arkansas, where I spent 4 years at 180 feet in the ground, 2 days a week, two 24-hour days, I might add, underground, ready to, if the command came from the president, to send that thing on its way.
What was that like?
It was boring and boring, with a couple of times during the 4 years that it was terrifying. So I have stories that I still can't tell.
So you can't tell how close
we
came.
I can't say I can't tell, because that's long been declassified, and all those missile sites now have aged to the point that they've taken them away. All our missiles now are out in the west, like Montana and Nebraska and that area. We had one night that we were teetering on the brink of war, and my crew was just sitting there ready to go. I mean, the keys were out of the safe. The keys were in the launch deals. We had authenticated top secret messages, and we were sitting there ready to go. And in an instant like that, the thoughts that go through your mind, it's really time for deep thinking. So I still have nightmares about that night.
Can you say anything more about that night? What was going on?
We were about 10 minutes away, and we received another message that told us to take our keys out of the where they fit to launch the missile and put them back in the safe. The next day, they always picked us up by helicopter and took us back to the base. They made a crew change like that. The next day, they took us directly to a debriefing area and told us that, guys, this wasn't a test last night. Our B-52 bombers were in the air. You guys were sitting there ready to go. And it wasn't a test. We wouldn't put anybody through that. Hey, it's the first time in my 4 years that I'd ever had to take that key out of the safe. So I knew they weren't playing around, because normally when we simulate stuff, you simulate putting a key and you go from there. So they said there had been a test launch by the Russians. They had launched simultaneously like four missiles. The satellites picked up the flashes coming out of their silos. And in fact, what it later turned out to be, they were seeing just how much we could see. And when we reacted, because there were things their satellites could see that we had done, i.e. like launching our B-52 force, and we had to harden the missile silo to the point that they knew, we knew that they had made this test launch. So it turned out to be, you know, just a reconnaissance type thing for them. I guess they learned what they learned, and I'll never forget it. It was a long night. And by the way, all those crews that night that were on alert didn't have to go back on alert for 2 weeks. They gave us 2 weeks off. And some guys never went back on alert because we were all on the human reliability program, and some of the guys just couldn't do it again.
Do you drink beer?
Oh, absolutely.
What's your favorite?
Miller Lite. That's our largest seller, and I'll always be, grateful for being hired by the Miller Brewing Company. So I know Ben Davis and others don't want to hear that it's not intuition, but no, Miller Lite. I'm a lower calorie drinker.
You can have intuition for your second beer.
But remember one thing, Karen. There are two kinds of good beer, cold beer and free beer.
What else would you like to share?
It's great to be in a city this vibrant. I'm the luckiest guy in the world. Like I said, I've never had a job. I have a hobby, and I love what I do, and I look forward to coming in every day and working with our great staff. So I'm looking forward to finishing up this office and turning the page and continuing to grow in the great, bold new city of the South.
Well, Earl Benton, CEO of Champion Brands, thanks for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you very much.
You can check out the profile of Earl Benton Jr., CEO of Champion Brands here in Jacksonville, in an upcoming issue of the Daily Record. Much more still ahead. We'll be right back.
UF Health Proton Therapy Institute. Over a decade of proton therapy experience, research advances, and compassionate care for cancer patients. In Jacksonville and online at floridaproton.org.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member, sign in, and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
Hey there, it's Joshua Johnson with a quick question. Are you a good listener? I'd guess you say you are, but why is it that at a time when we can consume more news and listen to more radio than ever, many of us have just stopped listening to each other? Every day on 1A, we'll champion your right to speak freely, and we know you're ready to talk. So join me, Joshua Johnson, next time on 1A from WAMU and NPR. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. He is an Olympic coach who has helped a local rowing organization take two boats to national championships in his first year on the job. And if you're looking for a cool summer camp for your kid, well, the First Coast Rowing Club is accepting applications right now. Here with more about the sport and the opportunity, we welcome Paul Mocha, head coach of the First Coast Rowing Club. Good morning.
Good morning.
And two of his young rowers heading to the U.S. Rowing Youth National Championships this year, Sanjay Mocha and Danielle Forbes. Hey, kids. Good to see you. All right, well, we'll hear from the kids in a moment, but first, Paul, you're an Olympic coach, and you've had huge success in just 1 year in this role. Rowing's been popular, I think, around town for a while because of our beautiful St. John's River, but you've upped the game. Tell me a little bit about what's happening with First Coast Rowing Club.
Well, you know, when I took on the job, it's the first time I actually worked with youth rowing. So I was a little apprehensive at first because it's quite a big difference from the Olympic level.
Sure, yeah.
But I thought it was a good opportunity. The club has been around a long time. You know, it started out as the Stanton High School program, and then it became a club that was open to anyone. And recently we changed the name to the First Coast Rowing Club to kind of encompass that we are a community rowing club that's open to everyone. And just started it out. And my son, who's here now, is a junior, so this was a prime year for him to get ready to get recruited for college, and thought it was just a great opportunity to come up here and work with this group and this program that's been around and been very successful.
Sanjay, a lot of parents encourage their kids to row. Where I grew up in the Midwest, it was called crew. I guess here in Florida, we call it rowing. Parents think, oh, if you can do that, you'll get a scholarship. Is that why you got into it, or do you just love the sport?
I mean, being around the sport forever with my father, like, that's how I fell in love with the sport. And I guess college has always just been a dream rather than something I needed to do.
Right. So what do you love about it?
Well, I guess rowing is so different in the sense that as a team sport, there's not very much room for deriving from the team. Like, you have to be really involved with everyone that you're rowing with and mimic everything that the person in front of you and behind you is doing. And it's just a great team building.
That is a huge team building exercise. Yes. And you can see it when you see a champion team out there on the water. Danielle Forbes, tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got into rowing.
Absolutely. Well, my sister and I, we did soccer for a while, and my parents, after Amanda, my sister, quit, she wanted to do something else. So we had driven by SRB and now First Coast every day on our way to school. And my mom always said, wow, you know, you should try rowing. It looks really fun. And so after that, my sister started to row, and she was on the team a year before I was. And then the next year, I joined. And it was nice because I had kind of somebody that I already knew there who I could talk to and start to get to know the sport through. And we fell in love with it. We love it. We've been here. She's been here 5 years. I've been here 4 years. And it's been a fantastic addition to our life. It's wonderful.
What do you love about it?
You get to be outdoors. The water, it's beautiful, especially when we have Saturday mornings. We go out on water and the sun is rising and it's flat water and you get to go row. And it's wonderful because you're experiencing all that nature and being outdoors, and you're also doing a sport that you really enjoy. And that's what I most love about it.
And you two are the stars of this, I guess, current crop of rowers. Thanks to Coach Mocha's instruction and your own talent, you're going to the U.S. Rowing Youth National Championships. How excited are you about that?
It's been a dream for a while.
Yes.
A dream. So where is this happening? When? Tell me everything.
Well, it's in California. So we're actually leaving next week.
June 6th, yeah.
June 6th for that race. And then we travel, and then we practice for a day. And then we've got 3 days of racing that we're going to go through and hopefully come out with some medals.
Yeah, bring home some hardware.
Absolutely.
And are you hoping to get scholarships from rowing? Is that in the plan too?
Personally, I've always been forward-headed and trying to talk to coaches right now. So I've been emailing back and forth. I know that she's been talking to a few coaches as well, so that's the goal, at least for us too.
Yeah, and as his parent, not his coach, yes, I would hope we get a scholarship.
Yeah, really.
With the cost's goal.
Dad would love that. So why do you think kids and their parents are attracted to this kind of sport? This is the time right now, I think, when a lot of parents out there are listening are looking for a cool activity for their child, and this is one that they might not have thought of. What is it about this sport, do you think, that molds kids? It's a really interesting team building exercise, as your son said, but there are other things that go into rowing.
Yeah, it's very unique. It is a lot of training. It's not easy. We're doing a lot of training. So there's a lot of cross training, running and body circuits, and we have rowing machines that we train on. And then our on the water activity is, you know, they're doing 8 to 10 miles of rowing a day. But what makes it unique is that there are no superstars in rowing. Everyone depends on everyone else. So everyone is accountable and everybody is as important as everyone else, whether you're the best one on the team or not the best one. And the sport also offers an opportunity for people that we can take large numbers of kids. It's not like you try out and you don't make it and you get cut, or you make it and you're not very good and you sit on the bench and watch. In rowing, everyone's out in boats, and there are a lot of categories. There are freshman events, there are middle school events, there are JV events. So when we do go to competitions, it's like you would go to a swim meet or a track meet. There are many different events, so we place people and give them opportunities to race, which a lot of other sports just by their makeup cannot do. And so I think that a lot of kids who don't fit into the traditional sports find rowing somehow. And they, even if they're not great out of it, it's transformative for them. They mm-hmm. learn about discipline. They learn about how hard they can work, and they can do a lot more than they thought they could. And the whole team aspect, and then again being out on the water and moving boats through the water is very unique. And
yeah, it is beautiful to watch. And we're so lucky to have this river and make this sport accessible to youth in our area. At the same time, I'm curious to get your thoughts about the stereotype of crew rowing as an upper class thing. You know, I think of the Winklevoss twins in the movie
yes.
The Social Network. They're so rich and privileged, and rowing on those machines at Harvard. And what about parents that want to get their kids into this, but they're not as well off?
Yeah, well, it is. We still fight that stereotype, although you know, it started in the Ivy Leagues and it started at the prep schools in the New England area, but they are now so much the minority in the rowing community. There are 48 rowing clubs in the state of Florida all over, and they are from every walk of life. And yes, it costs to row just like it costs to do any sport, but it is open. The community's, it's wide open to anyone, and that's what the youth programs are about. It doesn't matter what high school you go to, where you live. There is an opportunity to row, and we also offer scholarships to those that financially may not be able to afford the entire thing. And I think that provides opportunities for people who may think that that the door is not open for them.
Mm-hmm. Sanjay.
Well, personally, I started rowing, of course, in Miami before I moved up this year, and my club was open to everyone, and we had kids from the local public schools coming in mm-hmm. from all, I mean.
And where do both of you go to school, by the way? Danielle and Sanjay, where are you going to school?
I go to Stanton.
Stanton.
And personally, right now, I'm homeschooled, but okay. Earlier in the year, I was actually going to Wolfson.
And when kids come out to summer camp, they'll meet kids from all over the city. Let's talk about the camp for a minute. You're still accepting applications
absolutely.
For summer camp, right?
We do. Our first group of camps start June 11th and they go through June 22nd. And it starts at 9 in the morning and goes till 3:30 in the afternoon, Monday through Friday. And it's open to middle school and rising high school freshmen and sophomores that have never done it before. The idea is to expose them to the sport. They'll get a chance to row on the water twice each day. They'll do some land workouts and have lunch and some free time. And just, it's an idea to expose people to a sport where they don't have to make the full commitment for a year, but have a chance to expose their kids to it and the parents and to see if it's something that they might want to continue and join us in the fall during our season.
Sarah tweets the show, First Coast Rowing transformed my 14-year-old daughter. She found a second family at the club, learned how to work hard and get results, and she dropped 2 dress sizes last season. Learning teamwork, responsibility, accountability, humility, and more, rowing builds great human beings. And it's good exercise. Right?
Yes,
and people, the kids need to be aware, though, it's beautiful, you're on the water, but it's summer and you get hot and it's a lot of hard work. Danielle.
It is, but in my opinion, it's worth it because all of the things you're doing every day, it's with people who you enjoy spending time with. Personally, for me, the club is my second family. I consider it to be my second home. I go there every day after school. I'm there on the weekends. I live there. We row every day with these people, and you're in the same boats with these people. You win and you lose races with these people. They're people that you see every day and that you can't really imagine your life being without them, and that's really important to me, and I think it's something that could be really beneficial to our community for more people to get involved with that because it is really beneficial.
Well, it's as I said, an option for your child this summer, First Coast Rowing Club, and if you search them online, they're the former Stanton Riverbank Rowing if you have trouble finding them. So thanks all three of you for being here and good luck at the national championships.
Thanks so much for having us.
Paul Mocha is the head coach of First Coast Rowing Club. Sanjay Mocha and Danielle Forbes are two of the rowers heading to the U.S. Rowing Youth National Championships later this year in California. A quick break, and when we come back, our own Electro Lounge host David Luckin with some new music for your Monday. That's after this.
UF Health Proton Therapy Institute. Over a decade of proton therapy experience, research advances, and compassionate care for cancer patients. In Jacksonville and online at floridaproton.org.
Reporter Barry Meyer was the first journalist to shed a national spotlight on the abuse of OxyContin. His reporting concentrates on the intersection of business, medicine, and public health. His latest work breaks new ground and traces the missteps that turned a wonder drug into one of the key causes behind a national tragedy. Barry Meyer, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, David Sedaris returns to read from his new collection of personal essays, Calypso, and to talk about a lot of things, including life at age 61, the reasons he and his longtime boyfriend are monogamous but have not gotten married in spite of marriage equality, and how he tries to harness his OCD in creative and productive ways. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
When NAFTA became law in 1994, there were more than 500,000 people working at American textile mills, but now just two mills are still in business.
Going back and trying to rebuild NAFTA into what it was before then, nobody is saying that. I'm certainly not saying that.
I'm Amy Scott, Global Trade and American Manufacturers, next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's Turntable Tuesday tonight at 9 on our own Electro Lounge. Host and music director and station manager David Luckin is here to spin for us. And a minute ago on the show, I said it was Monday. It's Tuesday.
Oh, who can keep track after a day off like that?
That's right.
I hope you had a good holiday.
I did. How about you?
It was great. Just chilled out.
That's right. And we're going to chill out tonight on Turntable Tuesday. What are you going to be playing?
We have got this great vocalese group from the 50s called Lambert, Hendrix, and Ross. And once you hear these folks, you're going to flip. So we could just go right to the music straight up, and we'll talk about it on the other side.
Way he described it, he said I'd be better dead than alive. I didn't listen to his jive. I knew all along he was all wrong, and I knew that he thought
what?
I was crazy, but I'm not. Oh no,
oh no, no.
My analyst told me
what?
That I was right out of my head. He said I need treatment,
yeah.
But I'm not that easily led. He said I was the type that was most inclined when out of his sight to be out of my mind, and he thought I was nuts.
You know who they sound like?
Who's that?
Manhattan Transfer.
And before they ever even thought of it.
Decades before Manhattan Transfer were born, these guys were jamming in New York City.
And most of us know that song from Joni Mitchell because she covered them twice. She did Twisted, this song, with Cheech and Chong doing the background vocals or
and
voices.
And this is Lambert, Hendrix, and Ross.
Yep, Annie Ross, John Hendrix, and what's the other
name? Dave Lambert.
Dave Lambert. And
they were hot in New York in the 50s.
Yeah, all the way through to 62 when Annie was replaced by another singer. But just word jazz. You know, they were rapping before people were rapping.
That's right.
Doing cool jazz
music.
That's
so cool.
We're going to follow that with Frank Sinatra, a swinging session from 1961, where Frank covers a lot of his original recordings for Columbia, which were pretty mellow, with real swinging versions. And that's from the original vinyl, too, as Melissa can see here. We've got the original vinyl from 61 and from 58.
Yeah, David has brought the albums right here into the studio. By the way, people that have the opportunity to check out your studio and all your vinyl and all your CDs, they're always kind of a slack job with amazement.
Yeah. Looks like a slash radio station
it's
antique
cool.
shop.
Yeah, it's cool.
And then we'll round it out with Fred Astaire, his gorgeous recordings for Brunswick. And most people don't know, Melissa, that he released and introduced more American standards than practically anyone but Bing Crosby. Every great composer from Cole Porter to the Gershwin Brothers to Irving Berlin wrote for him. So the songs like Cheek to Cheek and The Way You Look Tonight, and They Can't Take That Away From Me, all those songs we know so well, Mr. Astaire introduced him because he had the best composers there were. So that's a fresh vinyl, too. You know what's interesting about this music is it got people through the 30s, through the Depression. And I want you to know, Melissa, it got me through the 70s.
Is that right?
Because it's just such happy music. You know, it wasn't Hendrix. It was something completely different. And
yeah.
I loved this in the 70s when I first bought it. I just got a fresh copy to play on the radio tonight.
Very nice. Now, all over the weekend, people enjoyed the music of the Jazz Festival. You got into the spirit of the festival by creating, out of nowhere, a pop-up jazz station on one of our HD channels. That has gone away, but you got a lot of enthusiasm and good feedback about that.
We got a lot of feedback. That's probably the most feedback I've seen in a long time. People really love the all-jazz format, and we're thinking about what we can do with that. It may come back in some form or another, or we certainly know that there's a lot of jazz fans out there. So it inspires me to play more jazz on the Electro Lounge to keep those folks happy.
Keep them happy.
Because it was very successful and we put it together pretty quick. So we probably could have spent more time on it. But what's it about? It's about a pop-up, right?
And it popped up and it went away, but more's coming. You never know what David has up his sleeve.
No, we keep working.
Tune in tonight at 9 because it's all fresh music this week on the Electro Lounge, beginning with Turntable Tuesday tonight. And people just, if they haven't listened after hours, they really need to, because it's music that you program along with some other talented hosts.
And coming up on Turntable Tuesday, how about some blaxploitation film music? We've got Marvin Gaye's Trouble Man, brand new vinyl, and Curtis Mayfield's Superfly. So that's next Tuesday. We're going to go down and play some good funk and soul on the Turntable Tuesday edition of the Electro Lounge.
Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. 1A's up next, how ranked choice voting is changing politics. That's coming up. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. We'll be back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. If you're catching our rebroadcast tonight, just keep listening for Electro Lounge. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.